From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, a former municipal emergency manager says state-appointed emergency managers don't work for school districts.
We're allowing our kids to fall further behind the curve.
You'd expect working on increasing trade ties with a country like China might include some complex transactions, but then there are the simple things.
The readership and writers in China haven't actually decided how to translate the word Michigan.
For the most part, business and government are on the same page when it comes to self-driving cars.
There's a real sense in the auto industry, you know, not just in the government, that this is extremely important.
And then Spartans got hit by a tough loss, but John U. Bacon says, hang on.
D'Antonio's teams always get better throughout the season. Do not dismiss these guys yet.
Those stories and even more. But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up, saying no to a bus-based mass transit system in southeast Michigan.
Why is the state of Michigan trying to do with buses what any other region in the country and in the world would try to do with rail systems?
But first, one of the state of Michigan's former emergency managers says it might work for some cities, but an EM just doesn't work that well for school districts. Tony Saunders is the former emergency manager of Benton Harbor. He was speaking as part of a panel at the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University, and he joins us now. I should note, you think emergency managers are working for helping cities to recover financial troubles. Why do you think they're not a good idea for school districts?
Well, I would say that I think EMs have worked in some cities. I wouldn't make it a carte blanche statement, and I think it's better than whatever alternative we may have, but if you consider the overall strategies that EMs deploy in cities, you know, reduction of cost, increased revenue from taxes or fees or fines, layoffs or benefit reductions and pension and healthcare modifications, and then most importantly, deferred capital expenditures or investment, and none of those work well in schools. So imagine in a city, if we defer CapEx, we may be talking about an office building or equipment or technology and training. And while this is extremely important, it's really just a short-term tool while we try to improve the balance sheet. Now, imagine the same thing occurring in a school district. When we defer CapEx or investment in a school district, we're knowingly ensuring that our students won't keep up with their peers across the state or the country or the world, for that case. And when we don't invest in a building that needs repair to save money in a school district, our kids are learning in subpar conditions, and we know that negatively impacts their ability to process information and concentrate. Or let's say when we don't invest in technology or curriculum in a school district, we're allowing our kids to fall further behind the curve. So essentially, we're limiting their growth potential with every investment we don't make. That may work well in a city on a short-term basis, but it won't work at all in a school district, and not even including the public perception issue that exists in a school district, where it's extremely difficult for a parent to send their kid to a district that's labeled financially distressed, right? Like, what type of parent would want to send their kid to a school district that's labeled financially distressed? So it creates this huge public perception issue, in my opinion, and it's generally pretty divisive. In a city, they experience the same public perception issue as you've seen in Benton Harbor or Detroit, but it's much harder for a family to relocate their residence versus their ability to move their children to a different school.
Right, just to the neighboring district. Now, I want to make sure I understand you. What you're saying is, and I don't put words in your mouth, but it sounds like what you're saying is, if you let a pothole go for a year, that's one thing. But if you let a kid's education go for a year or be diminished, that's completely different.
Exactly. So you know, imagine in a city, if I wanted to save money, one of the strategies we may deploy, we may have trash pickup every 2 weeks instead of every week, right? So, you know, obviously that's an inconvenience for the resident. However, imagine a similar strategy to being deployed in a school. It's just not feasible because every time we do that, we know that we're putting our children at a disadvantage. And then generally, parents, they actually utilize their voice with their ability to take their kid from the public school district to either a neighboring district or to a charter school or a private school. It's just extremely difficult for that same parent to move their family if they're in a city that's not providing, you know, A1 services compared to their ability because of the choices that we have here in the state of Michigan, for them to walk with their voice is a little bit easier in a school district.
Right, gotcha. So recently the Herald Palladium reported that the state superintendent of education, Brian Whiston, told the Benton Harbor School Board that he thinks the state should work with the worst performing school districts on things such as social work help, social emotional help, nutrition issues, and so on. State legislative leaders have been talking about just closing these low-performing schools. What's your take on those approaches?
So what I'll say is I think technical assistance by the state is a really good solution. So the wraparound services that the superintendent mentioned make a lot of sense. And the technical assistance, if we want to be candid, a lot of the school districts that we see today, they have true financial management issues. They may not have the expertise. They're educators by training. So that type of collaboration makes a lot of sense. What we've seen in Detroit, for example, this is a very sensitive topic, and sometimes when you close a school district, you're actually exacerbating a problem. However, some schools just need to be closed after a certain period of time. I don't think this is a black and white issue. I think this is more of an art as well as a science when it comes to deciding to close a failing school because of performance or other factors.
I want to step back just for a second. You cited several cities at this panel, not school districts, but cities such as Benton Harbor, Lincoln Park, and eCourses, success stories of emergency management. But I think a lot of Michigan residents think of emergency management in Flint and the disastrous results that city is facing because of state decisions. How does that affect your thinking as far as your view that an emergency manager is a solution for cities?
Well, I'll put it this way. When I got to Benton Harbor, we had $1,300 in the general fund bank account. So imagine having 20 people that need to make a decision to ensure that an entire workforce gets paid the very next week. It's just not practical to sit in a room and have 20 people make a decision when you're in that type of financial distress. What I will say, as far as Flint, I think it's a good lesson surrounding two things. One, municipal funding and how we fund our local governments. But then two, I think it's an even better example of what type of deferred investment that we've given to our infrastructure. And without getting into the details that are well documented of what went wrong in Flint, I think it's a better example of the intentional kind of notion that we need to think a little bit more carefully in a more strategic fashion around our investments in the state. So I won't say that emergency management has been a failure because of Flint. What I'll say is I think we've probably failed ourselves with our inability to come together with some type of consensus regarding how we fund local governments and how we invest in our infrastructure.
On that same panel you were on for IPSR, the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at MSU, Peter Hammer from Wayne State argued that emergency managers don't work. It's flawed because the underlying cause of financial distress in the cities and school districts that have been taken over are majority African-American. Poverty is the cause. Structural racism is the root cause. What was your reaction to his argument?
The points that he made were great. I actually agree with the majority of what he said. The problem becomes, yes, those are systemic issues that need to be addressed. But again, as I mentioned the example in Benton Harbor, what do you do when you're faced with $1,300 in the bank account and you have a workforce that needs to be paid the very next week? Addressing those systemic issues, they have to occur. But simultaneously, you have to have realistic, practical solutions to address these financial crises in a short-term fashion. It's only reasonable. So imagine if we just allowed all of our cities to go bankrupt because of, you know, our need to address some of these systemic issues. The cost of borrowing and the cost of doing business in Michigan would drastically increase for all of our residents. So it's obviously in the state's best interest to address these crises in a proactive fashion. And while I agree with everything he said regarding some of the systemic issues, being from Detroit, and there was not one thing that he said that I took issue with, it's just not practical to address those systemic issues without addressing the immediate problem.
So, final question. What do you think the state should do when a school district's finances collapse to the point it cannot support itself, if not an emergency manager?
So I think there are probably, let's say, three solutions that I would advocate for. One, as I mentioned before, technical assistance. You know, working in collaboration with schools is a much better approach. You know, it ensures that educators remain largely in charge of education decisions. It prevents the public perception and community revolt issue that leads to decreased enrollment. And when decreased enrollment happens, it compounds every other problem that we discussed.
So the state assists instead of taking over.
Exactly. Okay. So in Benton Harbor, ironically, you mentioned in their school district, they have a very similar approach right now where they have a consultant there that's hired and paid for by the state, and they're attempting to work through their problems. Two, you know, the big elephant in the room is the way we fund schools is almost kind of inherently selfish, right? So if we're being honest with ourselves and we admit that it costs more to educate children in urban centers than it does anywhere else, now this will mean either higher taxes or reallocation of financial resources in the state that won't be distributed evenly, because we have to be honest with ourselves. It just costs more to educate kids in urban districts. We were talking about the wraparound services being something that's absolutely needed. That costs more money. And then lastly, what I would say is we just have to change the tone. So the kind of irony of our public discourse is that I think it took, what, a week for this transformational brownfield plan that allows businesses to keep sales and income taxes in the name of development. It took a week for that to pass committee. But the same taxes that would ultimately have been distributed to our schools and our cities and essentially help a DPS or a Benton Harbor school district, we're stifling money away from those school districts in a way. But at the same time, it took months to put together a financial package for Detroit Public Schools. And more importantly, during that time, the tone was essentially horrible. The left vilified the right, and the right vilified the left. And then most recently, the concept of giving teachers in Detroit more money, who are obviously paid well below market value, was called a waste of money by some of our leaders, right? So I think the most important solution in the short term is we have to change the tone, and the concept of leadership has to change before any of this can be accomplished.
Tony Saunders is the former emergency manager of Benton Harbor. He recently spoke at Michigan State University's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, outlining why he believes state-appointed emergency managers are not the right solution for financially strapped school districts. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Still to come, sports commentator John U. Bacon on golf legend Arnold Palmer.
Arnold Palmer is the guy who introduced golf to the masses of America when TV started televising the game.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. China is Michigan's third largest export market. On today's The Next Idea, we hear about a new organization, the Michigan China Innovation Center. It's up and running and planning to encourage more Chinese investment here. Brian Connors is the executive director of that new nonprofit. So tell me what the goals are.
The goal is to increase our business ties with China, given that it is soon to be the biggest economy in the world. We feel that we need to, as the state of Michigan, devote some special energies and resources to making sure that we are building relationships there and that we're also marketing the state of Michigan to let them know all the great things that are happening here in the Great Lakes State.
You were the China Business Development Manager for the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. What can your new organization do to encourage investment from China that you couldn't do while you were there?
Well, having an independent nonprofit will help in a couple of ways. I mean, for one thing, we'll be a little bit more dynamic, I think, in our hiring. You know, we do have a requirement that everybody who works at the new center is going to be bilingual. I myself spent about 8 or 9 years living in China, worked very hard on my Chinese, and it certainly says a lot when you go into a meeting with a potential collaborator in China and you speak the language and you understand the culture. So that will be one sort of unique capacity that we have in the new center that I think we didn't have as much of as we needed back in state government.
How many Chinese firms are active in Michigan right now? What kind of investment levels are we talking about?
So China is a relatively new player at investing abroad. Just given their economic history, they didn't have the capacity, but I think anyone who's picked up a newspaper or turned on the radio in the past decade knows that China is now an international powerhouse economically. So while when you look at foreign direct investment into the United States, historically, of course, looking back way into our history, the UK is a huge player. Germany had a massive wave of investment after World War II. Players like Korea and Japan were the first to come out of Asia. But China, while their overall levels of outbound investment are not that high in the States, we expect them to grow significantly in the coming years. At this point in Michigan, Chinese firms have invested about $3 billion, actually more than $3 billion, into Michigan's economy and created somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10,000 jobs. But the key is that we see, and I think a lot of other economists and economic development people see, that China's investment is expected to continue to grow pretty sharply in the next 10 to 15 years. So we want to make sure that we're able to address the challenges that come with that and also seize the opportunities that come with that.
A lot of that Chinese investment and expansion has been in auto parts suppliers. What are the industries are they interested or have they invested in Michigan?
To say that it's in automotive, I would say it's not quite the way we put it these days. You know, as the automotive industry is reinventing itself, people are talking about mobility. People are talking about intelligent connected vehicles. And, you know, China is now being the largest automotive market and the largest producer of light automobiles in the world. They want to be a leader in that. So this is not just a matter of we're trying to attract a few automotive suppliers from China. It's that we need to keep an eye strategically in the long run on what is happening as China transforms its domestic automotive or intelligent connected vehicle industry and see how that aligns with what's happening here as Detroit sustains its leadership in the North American market. So, you know, automotive or, mobility industry will continue to be huge, but there have also been other investments in areas like insurance, medical devices, also to some extent in real estate and education.
Yeah, a couple of buildings in Detroit, at least a couple, have been purchased by Chinese investors. Give me some specifics here. What's your top priority for getting more business connections, more investment between Michigan and China? What are you going to be doing today or this week?
One of the things we'd like to tackle is I think probably most people are blissfully unaware that Michigan is in that same strange space as places like Mumbai and Bombay or Peking and Beijing, where the readership and writers in China haven't actually decided how to translate the word Michigan. Shockingly, there are three different ways that are still used broadly of how to say Michigan in Chinese. So that branding issue is something that we need to work out in terms of generally continuing to market the state of Michigan. So that's one major initiative that we're going to try to tackle as soon as we can.
I thought you were going to be talking about complex transactions or something like that, but it's as simple as that, just understanding how to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, people in China, they know about Detroit. They heard of the Motor City. Unfortunately, they've heard more recently about Detroit's bankruptcy, from which the city, as everyone knows, is emerging. But that turnaround story is something that we love to get out there about Michigan. You know, likewise, they have heard of our great universities. They've heard of Michigan State University. They've heard of University of Michigan Ann Arbor. But they don't necessarily have a concept of the very states after which those two universities are named. So that's definitely a priority. One is to get out there and build the brand and recognition about the opportunities in Michigan so that when we do come across real opportunities for business together, whether it's inbound investment or trying to export more goods and services from Michigan to China, we're going in there in more of a warm call or a soft sell as opposed to a cold call where they've never even heard of Michigan before.
Brian Connors is the executive director of the nonprofit Michigan China Innovation Center. Thanks very much for telling us about it.
Thank you, Lester. Have a great day.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. When you think about water pollution, you might think about massive sewer overflows or factory pollution or agricultural runoff. But there's another type of water pollution that just might be in your backyard. Septic systems that have failed. They pollute lakes and streams around the state, in fact, around the country. Sean Hammond is with the Michigan Environmental Council. Your group is calling for some better rules for septic systems and inspections. What exactly do you want?
So, yeah, we really are looking for what's in a couple pieces of legislation already this year, introduced by the late Julie Pawlacki and Representative Driscoll. House Bills 5732 and 33 really just move us forward with a statewide septic code. We are the only state in the country to not have a statewide septic code, with 50% of our citizens getting their water from groundwater. It's very important to protect that resource, and we need a statewide solution to help protect that.
Is anybody inspecting these septic systems now?
In most of the state, no. We have 11 counties that have a time of sale inspection requirement, which is when the home is sold, the septic system is required to be inspected. And there are different requirements for alternative systems and for pump outs in those counties. But as far as the 72 other counties in the state, there's no rules on this. You put it in the ground, it gets inspected once, and then you never have to look at it again under the law.
What kind of damage can a faulty septic system cause?
We're looking at typical nutrient pollution, but in addition, we're looking at E. coli and other bacteria that can get into the waterways. In fact, a 2015 MSU study tested 64 rivers across the state, and in all 64, they found human E. coli, which is a indication of failed septic systems. The state estimates that about 10% failure rate on septics, and that is significantly lower than what has been found in other states as far as failing septic codes. And in fact, a latest report from Tip of the Mitt Watershed looks at Charlevoix County has found about a third of the aging septic systems have never been replaced. So they're either failing or on the verge of failure.
When I used to cover the environment, I remember a lake where people were getting their drinking water was polluted from septic systems. Are there any drinking water sources in the state at risk because of this?
You know, right now, we definitely say yes, but it's hard to tell just because we don't know a lot about these. There's no statewide registry. There's only those 11 counties that we even know where the septic systems really are. And in a lot of cases, we see, especially northern Michigan, a lot of these septic systems are very small. They were designed for summer use for a cottage, and now you have a multi-child family living in these year-round, and they're just not designed to handle that. So until we can get a registry and figure out where these septic systems even are, we really don't even know what the true risk is, even though we know it's probably great.
Something I read that really surprised me, that a septic system only lasts about 20 years, which seemed like a really short time to me. What happens to the system that it can fail in that short of a period?
You know, it's just how the systems are set up. They need to be regularly inspected and pumped out and looked at to make sure that they're working properly with the soils and all the setup that goes into these. These are highly technical systems in a lot of cases. And now we're seeing even a growth in some use of alternative systems where you can't install a traditional septic system, and those need to be inspected even more regularly. So it just really needs to be that upkeep and maintenance a lot of times can help extend the lifespans of these. And right now, with no maintenance requirement even to pump these out at a regular interval, it really just puts a lot of them at risk for failure.
Okay, so we're putting our water systems, our waterways at risk. But here's the problem. We can't seem to come up with the tax money to fix sewer overflow problems. These septic system problems would have to be paid by the homeowner, and the fixes are not cheap. So why crack down on them when we've got much bigger problems with these municipalities with inadequate sewer systems, and we're doing not much about that?
You know, this really is a whole statewide problem right now with a lot of the nutrient pollution and water quality issues. We see it in the ag sector. We see it in the urban water treatments. We see it in the suburban water treatments. And then we see it in the septic. So really, the state just needs to look at investing in our infrastructure as a whole. This includes putting more work into our septic code, as well as putting more work into our water infrastructure. And we know that the Governor's Infrastructure Council is going to be releasing a report hopefully near the end of November. And we should have some guidance on how to go about some of these other issues. But really, septics are one place where we are behind the entire nation on this. Like I said, we're the last state to even consider adopting a statewide septic code. Every other state has one. And with our precious water resources and our 50% of our state getting their water from groundwater, we have to move forward on protecting those resources.
Well, let's talk about that, because this legislation, as you mentioned, is sponsored by one legislator who has died. The other is running for Congress, a little busy. Is there going to be any action on this during the session before the elections, or is it going to be during lame duck session, if at all?
We're really hoping we do see a little bit of movement this year, at least a hearing of some sort, just to get the ball rolling. This was introduced in the House, and the House has only one scheduled session day between now and the election, so it looks like lame duck would be the earliest this could be taken up. And we are really pushing to make sure that this is brought up in this cycle. You know, this was one of Representative Pilecki's big initiatives that she worked on in her short time in Lansing, and we'd like to see this discussion moved forward as the session closes out here.
Sean Hammond is the Deputy Policy Director with the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks very much for talking about this.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Time now for our Monday roundup with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. The Big Ten spotlight was on East Lansing and Ann Arbor Saturday, with the Spartans hosting Wisconsin. Well, hosting.
They're a very generous host. How about that?
The Badgers won 30-6. The Free Press headline from columnist Drew Sharp: this Michigan State stink bomb versus Wisconsin, inexcusable. What was your take on that?
I would be a little nicer than that. But there it is, 30-6. The fact that they lost is not a shock. These are two top eight teams at that point. I figured it was going to be a battle, but nobody saw a 30-6 whitewashing. Bad turnovers, and shockingly, against a very good Michigan State defense, 30 points from Wisconsin is an eye-opener. And on top of that, the one big win Michigan State has got is over Notre Dame the previous weekend. Notre Dame at home lost to Duke. They are now 1-3, so perhaps that win is not so impressive.
So it leaves the Badgers at 4-0 and the Spartans at 2-1. What are the prospects for next week?
For Michigan State, look, D'Antonio's teams always get better throughout the season. Do not dismiss these guys yet. It may not be a national title year. It may not be a Big Ten title year, but do not dismiss the Spartans. The Badgers are the pleasant surprise for the Big Ten right now. They've beaten a top-ranked LSU team. They've beaten a top-10 Michigan State team. They come into Ann Arbor next weekend, and that will be a nationally televised game. That'll be big stuff.
Let's talk about Michigan. The Wolverines really paddled the Nittany Lions 49-10. Was that expected? You kind of expected that, didn't you?
I did, actually, yeah. Because they had a bad first half against Colorado, who turns around and beats Oregon, so you never know in this world. And then, of course, I knew they're going to put the paddle to, as you say. I like that term, by the way. It's nice. To Penn State, little alliteration there as well. Penn State is still reeling from the sanctions from years ago. It's still a mess of a program.
Looking ahead to next Saturday, big day for the MAC in our state. Central Michigan hosts Western Michigan. This is one of our state's big football rivalries, right?
It actually is, and is underrated, probably because if you didn't go to Central or Western, you may not be aware of this, but that is, I think, the biggest rivalry in the MAC, actually. They're lobbying to have ESPN Game Day come before the game.
Right, I read that.
Yeah, I give it a snowball's chance, Lester. But then, who saw Donald Trump debating Hillary Clinton tonight? So you never know in this world.
Well,
so
let's talk about their quarterbacks, because they both have pretty hot quarterbacks at this point.
They do, but the coolest name by far is Central Michigan's Cooper Rush. That's Central casting. Right now, he's ranked 12th in the nation. He might be an NFLer.
And Western's Zach Terrell, he ranks 16th.
That's right. They're 4-0 and 3-1. I bet both teams get to a bowl as they did last year. Also watch this. P.J. Fleck is the Western Michigan coach. They went 8-5 the last 2 years. With all the jobs opening up as usual around the country, I bet he'll be somewhere else next fall.
Well, let's talk about the NFL and the Lions. Bet you there are a lot of Youpers who are pretty happy right now because the Green Bay Packers beat the Lions 34-27.
There you go. See, Lester, that's a fine point right there, by the way, Lester. Well done, sir. Youpers, of course, are not loyal to the Lions. They are loyal, of course, to the Pack.
Right, yeah. So what's your highlight, low lights for that game?
I've seen it for 50 years. Nothing's changed. How's that? To make it quick.
The Tigers open a four-game home series against Cleveland tonight. It's the last week of the season. They're wrapping it up in Atlanta next weekend. Where do you think we'll see them in postseason?
Now, this is utterly heartbreaking. They had a half-game lead on the wild card midweek last week. On Saturday, they're ahead 4-2, Lester. Ninth inning, two outs, two strikes. They're one strike away from basically securing a spot, and they blow it and lose 7-4. 5 runs off that one little strike, and there you go. So Tigers
fans. This is why I like baseball more than any, because that kind of stuff only happens in baseball.
Baseball and cricket.
Yeah.
No clock, man.
Last but not least, the Red Wings opened training camp last Friday with a big hole in the lineup. No more Pavel Datsyuk. What's it going to mean for the team?
It's a big loss. He's one of the most talented players in the NHL. Near the end of his career, I grant you, but also a great leader. This team right now is always scraping by to get in the playoffs. They've got a new arena opening next fall.
Right.
They are very focused on that fact.
Well, how are they going to fill the hole with Datsyuk gone?
Some young guys got to step up.
But what there's happened Abdicator. This
season? I don't know. How about that? Look, right now, a pretty average team.
Hmm.
So one last thing we've got to get in here. Rest in peace, Arnold Palmer.
Right, 87.
87 years old.
And obviously beloved by all golfers, or at least I don't know anybody who didn't love him.
And also internally as well. He's a golfer's golfer. He's more beloved internally than Jack Nicklaus and certainly Tiger Woods, who's not that beloved, frankly, amongst his peers. Arnold Palmer is the guy who introduced golf to the masses of America when TV started televising the game. He's amazingly charming, good-looking, would never blow off anybody. He's the golf pro's son who knows how to look you in the eye every time he shakes your hand. I've met him a few times. You don't forget it.
That's another loss. We've seen a lot of them in this year so far.
Truly.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Up next, NPR's auto industry correspondent Sonari Glinton talks about self-driving cars.
Safety is important, and that's really what autonomous vehicles are about.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Last week, the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, was making the rounds of the news outlets, really excitedly talking about new guidelines for autonomous cars. But frankly, Secretary Fox admitted there was a lot not covered in the guidelines because there's a lot the industry and the government have yet to figure out. Sonari Glinton is the automotive reporter for NPR, and he joins us now. Sonari, what's up with issuing guidelines before really understanding the issues or the potential problems?
Well, first of all, Lester, he's excited about it, but there's a real sense in the auto industry, you know, not just in the government, that this is extremely important. Safety is important. And that's really what autonomous vehicles are about. More than 36,000 people die every year in a car crash, and 94% of those accidents are caused by people. And there are only four things that people are doing that cause those accidents. They're distracted, they're asleep, they're drunk, or they're driving too fast.
All those facts are there. We all know them. We're aware of them. We're still not going to put our trust into mechanisms that we don't have control over. And so all the data and all the facts will not replace the mistrust that we have in letting go of the steering wheel.
Well, I think that there should be a lot of skepticism, but I don't necessarily think it's about getting into a machine that drives itself, right? You've probably been on a roller coaster, you've definitely been on an elevator, and you've been on an escalator, right? These are machines that move by themselves, and people understand that. And I think right now, people are already giving up control because they're reading their phones in their cars and things like that, right? But the real thing, and I think that is, you know, someone who covers the industry, and as you know, there's a lot not to trust in the auto industry. It's almost exactly a year since Volkswagen's diesel emission scandal came out. It is, you know, we're not that far from bankruptcy of two of the big companies. We're, you know, a record recall season. That's where we really need to be questioning. We really need to be questioning not only the automakers, but our government leaders. And what is this going to mean?
Let's step back just for a second, because you brought up, you know, the trust we have in GM and Ford and Volkswagen and Toyota and even Tesla. These important moral questions you're talking about, you know, all these lives we're losing each year, they're a very important question. But are we going to say, well, these companies that, you know, have had their problems in the past are going to answer all those problems for the future and we'll have a much safer transportation system? How much trust do we put in to GM, Ford, Volkswagen, Toyota, Tesla to get it right so that we can see these kinds of reductions if we end up going in this direction as it clearly appears we are?
Well, you know what? This is an inflection point, right? And I think we might be paying attention in the way we weren't paying attention during the days of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, right? That movie is not factual, but is very true, right? It's an inflection point. We get to make the decision now before the cars get on the road. And I think that that is about not only the car makers, but our local and state governments and the federal government, which Anthony Fox and the Department of Transportation said is they laid out ground rules that says we are going to be monitoring this. We are going to regulate this. This is where we're putting our flag down. If you're going to sell an automated car, the code and the vehicle, that's going to be regulated by the government.
So are you optimistic that we're going to see automated vehicles, become commonplace within 5 years, 10 years? How long is it going to be?
I think that you and I are going to have to work out our frustrations about giving up the wheel, right? But one of the places we're definitely going to see it is going to be in places that are commercial. I definitely feel like we're going to see long-range trucking automated. We're going to see a lot of sort of delivery services that are automated, and that's going to come very, very, very soon, I think within 5 years. I just bought a car in June. Lester, I think it might be the last car that I drive independently on my own. There are tens of billions of dollars being spent right now to fast track this, because if you think about what Mark Fields has said to me and all the car company people will say is like, look, there's about $2 trillion in the auto industry, and there's $11 trillion in the transportation industry. And the car makers see their path to growth being tapping into that. That not just that you own an individual car, but they might be a part of these systems that move us around. And I think that there is a real push to get there, not only because of safety, because, you know, a self-driving car by its nature is going to be cleaner than a car with a driver, that there's so many reasons on the balance sheet, on the moral sheet, to get us to this point that there is almost no stopping it because the companies really want it. And I think eventually what they have to do is to convince us. The government has to convince us that this is viable. But I think that we're going to see trucks real soon.
I want to ask you one more question. This is just a little off topic, but Michigan has been thinking about legislation to try to update its rules for autonomous cars. Michigan really wants to be the center of this world. You've lived in Michigan. You live in California. Is California so far ahead of us on autonomous cars that Michigan will never catch up? Or do we still have a chance in Michigan to be competitive in this sector of the automobile industry?
Everybody has a chance, Lester, because, I mean, what it is this is a gold rush, man. It is. And one of the key things, I talked to an engineer who was talking to me about the infrastructure. Now, you know, the big tech companies out here, the Googles, you know, the Apples, the Teslas that are working towards making autonomous vehicles. But one of the key things that Michigan has and other places, it's like looking at the infrastructure and what the changes in the infrastructure can do to move this process along. We've made almost no changes to infrastructure in the last 60 years. And that is going to be really difficult. We're going to have these state-of-the-art vehicles that are 2016 running on roads that are 1950. And that is the edge that places like Michigan can have if it can invest in the technology and in the infrastructure that will move the state closer. There's no winner. Pittsburgh is got autonomous cars because of Uber. Nevada, all these states are competing. And I think this is the future. And I think that it is a boon. And I think that Michigan has a role to play, especially with its deep knowledge of the manufacturing of vehicles. That's one of the things that we don't have in California, is an understanding of manufacturing. And so I think that gives Michigan an edge in a way that Nevada and Pennsylvania and some other states don't have.
That's Sonari Glinton. He's an NPR correspondent. He covers the auto industry for NPR and an old friend. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The Regional Transit Authority of Southeast Michigan's new transportation plan needs money. So, on the ballot in November, voters in Macomb, Oglin, Washtenaw, and Wayne counties will be asked to approve a 20-year property tax millage said to cost the average homeowner about $95 a year. Now, that will pay for new bus rapid transit lines, some rail service between Detroit and Ann Arbor eventually, and fix what has been a dysfunctional transit system that never really connected the suburban smart bus with the Detroit Department of Transportation bus system. Some people in the suburbs, mostly older folks, are not happy for a variety of reasons, but the chief reason seems to be they feel they'll have to pay for a bus system that they'll never use. Many younger voters feel a little differently. But there are others opposed to the Regional Transit Authority tax for other reasons. Michael Jackman with the Metro Times says the RTA doesn't go far enough. It's short-sighted in its dependence on bus rapid transit system. And he joins us now. So if not this RTA plan, what do you think will work better?
Well, I keep going back to the original legislation that created our RTA in Southeast Michigan. And written into its rules are some pretty stringent standards for whether the system can ask voters to fund and let it operate rail systems at all. It requires a unanimous vote from all the board members to propose such a system or in order to run it, whereas the law only requires a supermajority when it comes to buses.
So what do you think they're throwing up obstacles to developing light rail or commuter rail in the state?
Well, I can't say why that was written into the laws. I think it's just our local officials don't like the idea of spending a lot of capital costs on installing rail systems that will, you know, run streetcars or light rail vehicles in the inner city, which is where they make most sense.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, too, because when you're talking about a rail system, you're talking about infrastructure that will take years to launch, decades to fully develop. Detroit residents need reliable transportation right now, and the only immediate hope is riding a bus. So does your long-term vision get in the way of today's problems?
Well, I think we do have bus systems right now, and, I mean, buses have their place, certainly as feeder vehicles for main thoroughfares and things like that. The thing is that, you know, the same mentality that says we can't afford these capital costs for rail systems is often the same thing that when they propose a so-called BRT line, the same powers that be that are in charge of those decisions that led up to it often cheap out in a number of other ways, getting rid of signal preemption, pre-ticketing, the climate-controlled stations. All of a sudden, what you're looking at in the end is just another bus line. Is there a problem with that? Well, the holy grail of, you know, transit authorities is what we call transit-oriented development. In other words, they fix a rail route in the street that carries thousands of people there day by day, and developers see that, and they start spending money to develop the restaurants, condos, and other amenities right by that rail station. So instead of having a system that seems designated for taking poor working people out to the counties to work on Hall Road, you could have a system that creates development in the inner city where people can walk or bike to work, and it creates jobs where they're needed the most.
I get your point. I understand that, but you haven't answered that question about the immediate problem of reliable transportation. It's one of the chief barriers to getting a job for many Detroit residents. Wouldn't that in itself spur economic improvement for the city?
Well, I don't see where any bus line has actually reorganized the way jobs are distributed in a metropolitan area. I mean, the real problem isn't that there isn't reliable transit to take people out to the jobs so much as the jobs are located miles and miles away from the people who need them the most. If we could understand that transit policy is development policy, maybe we could jumpstart those inner city places and get them the jobs that they need. Would it take a while? Do we need reliable bus system in the interim? Sure, and I think that some deal-making could be done between SMART and DDOT to get those systems working better together, but building another series of bus systems, I don't know. I mean, down the line, I don't see it really challenging the status quo, which is what...
You're more of an optimist than I am, because we've been waiting for SMART and DDOT to get their act together for decades, and they still haven't managed it.
Well, if that wasn't the purpose of having the RTA to sort of knock some heads together and get those systems working with the, you know, with the Ann Arbor system as well, what was the whole point of authorizing another transit agency?
Now, you did note that in one of your articles, I forget which one, that they did loosen up on the rail a little bit. They're talking about this light rail or commuter rail between Detroit and Ann Arbor. That gets to a little bit of what you want, but it still doesn't deal with that job situation, which I think is the critical part of this whole idea. I understand what you're saying. You're wanting to see transportation and development work hand in hand. But in the meantime, there are a lot of people, a huge number of people out of work in Detroit who just want to get to, you know, I'll remind you of the walking man who's trying to get there. I did a piece on a woman who, you know, finally got a job in Warren until her car broke down and there was no bus service to get to the job. There's that problem right now. And I think a lot of people are saying you're letting good be the enemy of great.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can provide the bus service that's going to get people across town. I think that's a component of the plan, and I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is wedding us to another 20-year program that in the end is going to leave Metro Detroiters saying, gee, you know, transit just doesn't work in Metro Detroit. Isn't that strange? You know, and it's not a mystery. This can all be traced back to the legislators who are enabling the funding. You noted well that they loosened up a little bit because they realized that their RTA was not going to be able to legally operate the system that they want for Ann Arbor and Detroit, that they want for downtown Detroit. You know, the RTA wouldn't have been authorized to do that. They would have to have a unanimity. And I think it gives you an idea of just how impossible they perceive that to be politically, that unanimous vote, which is why the possibilities of rail transit remain unexplored in our region or impractical.
So what's your bottom line? What do you want the RTA to consider? I mean, are you saying you want a no vote on the RTA, or are you saying they need to step back and rethink it and then present it again? Because if they get a no vote now, it's not going to be before the voters for a long time.
What's the hurry? Why is there so much pressure now to pass a plan? Why is bus rapid transit on our must-try list? Why is the state of Michigan trying to do with buses what any other region in the country and in the world would try to do with rail systems? Is it worth a year or two to go back to the drawing board to see if we can change some of these legislative requirements that we're saddling our RTA with? Why not give people a real choice, one that isn't tilted away from the modes that intimidate our legislators because the plans are too big or too expensive or would challenge the way we do things in Metro Detroit? I think it's worth it.
I don't want to sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but I'm still thinking about those folks who would like to get a job now, not in a year or two or longer. And the other point of that, I think, is as difficult as it was for the counties to get together, even get this on the ballot with the last-minute backroom dealing that had to be done to do that, I'm not sure that you're going to get many changes from the legislature or from the county players.
Well, Zemke was able to in Ann Arbor. There is some potential for political deal-making, you know, and as for those people who suffer without transit, without the ability to use transit to get them to the jobs right now, you know, that is a situation that they've been in for years. It seems strange to me that now we're on the verge of passing this plan, and all of a sudden, to foreground the urgency of their persistent and stubborn problems, you know, it's convenient for the passage of the RTA to do so now. But how about really challenging the status quo and taking a more long-term vision and driving that inner city development with real international standard of light rail transportation? You know, this has not endeared me to a lot of my friends, you realize, to stand over here on the left of the proposal and to be shouting that we should reject it and do more. But at the same time, I feel that it does more damage in the end. You know, while we're going to be putting in these bus rapid transit lines, which eventually I imagine will be bus lines, we're spending more than $2 billion to expand our freeways. Why are Michigan's transit priorities seemingly out of the 1950s and 60s instead of where they are today with other cities and other metropolitan regions?
I can hear our next mass transit lobbyist in Lansing right now. His name's Mr. Jackman. Okay, that's Michael Jackman. He's with Metro Times. He recently wrote a pair of opinion pieces critical of the RTA's bus rapid transit plan. A millage to fund that plan will be on the ballot in Macomb, Oakland, Washtenaw, and Wayne counties this fall. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, sir.
And that's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.
I am a passenger.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.